Okay, good morning, everyone. Thanks for being a bit patient. We're a little bit behind getting started. We're just having some issues projecting my my second machine screen up on the monitors there. Thank you for coming to the early 8:15 session. I'm sure it was pretty hard to drag yourselves out of bed this morning, especially if you were out last night. Welcome to How to Architect the Private Cloud. My name's Gareth James. I'm a senior consultant with Microsoft Consulting Services. And I'll just put a little bit of context, excuse me, about what this session is. A while ago, when Microsoft really started thinking about what a private cloud is and what it should do, a group of architects in the services division said, okay, this is where we're going. This is the type of service that we want to provide. Let's put all the system center together and see what it looks like when we actually do that to produce that type of private cloud output. What the result of that was a system that we call DCS, which stands for Data Center Services. I just want to put it in context as to what that is. DCS is not a product that Microsoft sells, so it's not like System Center or Windows. It's a solution offering that's been created by Microsoft Services, which integrates all of System Center to deliver that private cloud capability into your organization. Now, the reason why I'm showing this is really twofold. Number one, if you are interested in the solution itself, it can be obtained from services. Speak to your friendly sales exec and they'll be more than happy to hook you up with services to come in to deploy it. But it's also an example of how the System Center suite can be used to build that type of private cloud capability. And what I'm going to be going through today is, for the first pretty much half of the deck, what were our core design tenets? When we started to architect this thing, what are the visions that we had, and what are the things that we wanted to conform to, and what did we want to supply? So this will give you an idea of how we think about private cloud, and then on the back half of it, I'll give you an example of how we specifically put it together, and hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll have a demo to display as well. So very quickly, I don't want to spend too much time on the marketing slides. You can tell they're marketing slides because they actually look good. You'll be no illusions when you get into my slides, I can tell you. So what are the challenges in the data? Well, why are we doing cloud? What challenges, what problems are we trying to solve? So, I mean, obviously, server sprawl is an important one. I mean, server sprawl was a problem back in the physical days, and then with the advent of virtualization, and we've just lost the deck. Thank you. in the advent of virtualization, that problem just got orders of magnitude worse. So what controls can we bring in to try and address that particular problem? We want really to try and allocate as much of our budgets as we can into not just sustainment, but into new capabilities. And the key to that for cloud is really a concept of delegation of authority, which I'll go into. We really want to try and give a two-world view of what we do, and that the business owner and the application developer as consumers of the service. Compliance and security is always a top issue. It's very well being able to provision things very quickly and give people a degree of freedom, but if it's not done in a controlled manner with good security, then it's really counterproductive to your business outcomes. And infrastructure complexity. You were saying there the average billion-dollar company maintains 48 financial systems and 2.7 ERP systems. Keep that 2.7 ERP systems in mind because that's going to be a joke later on. So private cloud is not just virtualization. It's another layer. It's another set of capabilities on top. Virtualization and good virtualization management is the core of it. It's really where it starts, but certainly there's a lot more that we need to do. So if we're looking at that graph there in terms of simply just virtualizing, you look at where your costs end up, and it's actually you are better off, but only just slightly. Obviously, most of your savings are in the area of capital expenditure because you're getting higher density on your physical equipment, so your spend there is going down. Your agility goes up, but so do your software costs, your labor costs, and your management complexity. So then over the total life cycle of the system, how much have you really saved? So the traditional virtualization approach is, firstly, you know, the system administrators, someone will make a request of the system administrator, so they'll say, okay, those 2.7 ERP systems we have aren't quite enough. I want 3.7 ERP systems. So they'll stand up a project to develop that additional system, and then they'll start to make requests of IT for, you know, this is the infrastructure that we need, and this is what, you know, dev, test, pre-prod, these are the environments, and we're going to stand that up. So they'll, you know, IT receives that request, usually after a, you know, bucket full of approvals and going through, you know, 15 CAB meetings. And then they'll provision the actual you know, base VMs. Now, quite often, being able to provision a VM quickly is nothing new, right? I mean, that's been with us for a long time. But that's so often not the end of the story once you've provisioned it. Then there's a number of subsequent processes that you need to go through for BAU to say, okay, yep, we've got this VM, and yes, our monitoring agent's on it and our antivirus agent's on it, and yes, it's been included into the backup system, and these are all the checks and balances that we need to go through to make sure this thing is of the standard that we want it so that we can adequately support it. So it's often they'll be, you know, provisioned in a specific silos. So you may have, you know, dev environment, test environment, you may have business silos. So that was that process that I was alluding to before about, you know, asset registration and making sure all those compliant processes are in place and everything's squared away. So ongoing maintenance, obviously, then sometimes can be a highly manual process in terms of patching and various other things. So at the end of the day, then business get ultimately what they asked for, but the organization doesn't have a really good handle on, you know, what the total cost of that was. They know what their total IT budget is, sometimes. but often when you are then asked for a breakdown of, okay, well, who's consuming what, and this is particularly important in organizations that you know, have internal transfers of money, when the CIO is going to try and fight for a higher IT budget than he had last year, he's going to be asked to justify that, and quite often that more granular breakdown is difficult to achieve. And that was what I was saying before, that the costs increase. See how much faster that was with private cloud? Awesome. So the goal of private cloud really is to, I mean, a lot of these things that you need to do. So let's take, for example, that process of, you know, the asset registration and then making sure your agent's on it and all that kind of thing. That we still need to do that. These things are there for a reason. We're not saying that you suddenly start carving off these processes like, you know, redundant limbs. But private cloud is really about very, very high degrees of automation cross silos. So what we want is a very well-defined standard across all of those silos of responsibility. And then we want to automate through all of those silos so that you get an end-to-end, that process is completed and there's very little, or if any, manual intervention. So that's one aspect of where we benefit from private cloud. What that allows us to do is, if we're automating that end-to-end process and you know, right, every time a VM gets provisioned, for example, it's going to be done by exactly this process, in exactly this way, in exactly this order, then you can do cool things like delegate the creation of that machine to someone who's not in IT. Because under normal circumstances, you'd never do that because you have no idea what sort of results you're going to get and how are IT supposed to support that. But if you control the process by which that gets provisioned and it's automated, you can get the cleaner to provision VMs if you want to. You're still going to end up with a very, very predictable result that you can support at the end of it. It also, and then a quick plug for the next session over in room 9, which is a smaller room. I shouldn't have put ITIL in the title of that session. We're doing a session on ITIL and the private cloud, which is really about, if we have this level of really high agility, how do we maintain good process control within that? And you can say that it absolutely can be done and is still very much within the ITIL framework. So the benefits of the private cloud. A shorter graph. That's what you can go and tell your management. So really it's about, I mean, the as you can see, the hardware spend doesn't really isn't affected too much, because I mean you're not actually gaining a lot of efficiency there. But where you are gaining, your software costs go down slightly, and that's based on, actually I'll start clicking through these things. Well, yeah, lower systems management costs, and that's really what it's about, is once that initial cloud is set up and those processes are established and the automation is done, then your running costs are very much reduced, because the system for the most part is churning away doing what it does with very little manual intervention needed by the administrators. They can just sit there, let it go, and it'll flag if it has some kind of problem, bring something to their attention if it needs to. But if things are healthy, it should just chug away doing what it does with very little effort from yourselves to maintain. So the lower software costs, that's just a marketing software licensee thing. I don't get into that. I'm a consultant. I don't sell software. I make it work. But they're talking there about the efficiencies and the economic benefits of actually being able to consolidate your data center licensing in regards to Windows Server Data Center and then System Center Data Center. And lower infrastructure and facilities costs, but not a huge gain over what you had before if you were highly virtualized and fairly efficient with that virtualization. So we obviously want agility, reduced costs, and increased focus. So where we gain that with private cloud are things that are up there, and a couple of them you could apply to just basic virtualization, and some of them are a little bit more, this is what cloud brings you. Obviously, the pooled resources, but we're looking at a higher degree of pooled resources as well, in terms of maybe not having that segmentation of clusters potentially that you had before, or maybe doing that a bit better if we're classifying service. Having it elastic, being able to sort of scale out and scale in as demand needs. Self-service and self-service and usage-based, and these are one of the two real keys, is you want to be able to delegate that authority to give people the ability to create the services that they need in a standard way that you can support, but then also you want either charge back or show back to be able to say, okay, well, the legal team is consuming X amount of our resources, and the finance team has a really poorly written app that they refuse to get rid of, and it's taking 50% of our fabric infrastructure because it's so inefficient. These are the types of things that potentially CIOs can arm themselves with this information when they go back to their boards to ask for their IT budgets, saying, well, if you want IT to be more efficient, tell finance to upgrade that rubbish finance app which is taking 50% of our fabric resources because it's so inefficient. So this really is a tale of two groups of people, really. It's the service consumer, so the person who's going to be consuming those resources from your fabric. So that's really all about, on-demand self-service, elastic consumption of resources, utility pricing, and even if you don't charge money internally, because some organizations don't, it's still very useful to be able to ascertain, who's consuming what out of your resources. And again, well-defined and consistent quality of service. When a person presses the button to get something, they know exactly what they're getting, and they get exactly the same thing spat out every time. And then there's the service provider's view. So this is really the admins and the fabric admins and the cloud admins. You want optimized resource usage, so you want to be getting the most out of your investments in hardware. Standardization and automation, that's key. Nothing gets provisioned out of a cloud unless there's a back-end service to support it, and you know exactly how it's done. So what we're moving to really is, we've been trying to get to a standardization place for years. This really helps us do that by giving your consumers sort of more limited choices than they would have had before. It's that age-old balancing act, right? The more standardized you are and the fewer things you offer, if you, say, offer, five things in your service catalog, there's not a lot of choice for the consumer, but the result of that is obviously greatly reduced cost to be able to provide that service. And then right on the other end of the spectrum, you've got every request is a custom request, and it requires changes and a degree of dev work to actually facilitate that request for everything that we do. I mean, that's great from the consumer's point of view in terms of infinite flexibility, but very, very, very expensive to maintain, and I would say in a lot of cases unsustainable to do things in that manner. And yeah, we have shaking hands and world's a happy place and everybody loves each other. So I've sort of covered this. I won't spend too much time on this slide, but really, you've got that, again, pool resources, self-service, elastic and usage-based. That's with any cloud, public or private. Those are sort of the main focuses of it. With a private cloud, you get an increased amount of control and a greater deal of how much you can customize. Again, it's that spectrum that I was talking about. You know, at one end, you've got fully public-based services that offer you X, Y, and Z, and if you want something different, they're going to go, no. But very, very inexpensive. And then right up to fully customized. So private cloud for you guys is something you decide how much customization you want to bring to bear, but you also then maintain control on how things are done. It's a very different economic model too. That's something else to consider. with private cloud, we talk about that utility-based pricing. I mean, people love the example of the power switch. You know, you flick the button, you pay for your electricity, you turn it off, you don't pay anymore. Which applies to public cloud. With private cloud, that economic model obviously doesn't apply because it's still your kit. It's still in your data center. It's still your CapEx. It's still your staffing costs. So it's really about bringing some of those efficiencies that we have from the public cloud, applying it to private cloud so that we then gain some of those benefits, but you are not going to get to the same economic model as a public cloud, obviously, because it's still your capital expenditure. So now that I've gone a little bit on what the core tenets of cloud are, I want to talk to the solution that we built specifically and where it was focused. So I haven't gone into those definitions of infrastructure service, platform as a service, and cloud as a service. I'm assuming that everyone's pretty much familiar with that by now. We've been hammering it ad nauseum for the last 2 years, so I would hope that most people have at least come across the terms. What this solution that service has built is focused on is at the infrastructure as a service layer, and that's provisioning of virtual machines. We do have other offerings up the stack that then obviously look at platform and software as a service. But we've also started to turn our attention to how do we apply those modes of thinking to things like internally developed line of business apps and those kinds of things. When I go and speak about this solution to customers, I get the question a lot that, yeah, VMs are great. What about my apps? I want to be able to extend this sort of cloud thinking to my apps. And my response to that is, well, yeah, that's the end game. That's obviously where you want to get to. But do you currently have a really well-managed automated fabric that can provision on demand, that can pull down on demand, that has very low running costs? And do you have that underlying infrastructure there? And the answer more often than not is, well, no. Well, you kind of need that first before you can start worrying about how you're going to wrap cloud attributes around your applications to get that kind of agility within your application set. So what were the things that we really had front of mind when we designed this infrastructure as a service private cloud? Well, the first one is what we call perception of infinite capacity. And it's obviously not possible to provide infinite capacity because no one has an infinite budget, but you want to provide that perception so that anytime someone goes and clicks the button to get service, that they get a result, or there's very clear boundaries and understanding as to why they haven't got that result. What we're trying to avoid through this is that thing of new projects come online, they want to get stood up, and it's, we're out of rack space, and we don't have much power left, and there's no ports left on the core switch, and we need to get another one of these things, and that's going to take another 6 weeks to provision. And we want to know ahead of time when we're going to hit those limits and deal with them so that your consumer is not faced with that reality. The reality is still there. You just want to deal with it with enough time and with good capacity planning so that your consumers aren't confronted with it. Perception of continuous availability as well. Service should always be up. For those of you who were in Jeff Woolsey's session yesterday with the anecdote with his daughter saying SesameStreet.com's not working because it didn't load in the first 3 seconds. There is that thing of, service always has to be on. Now, I'll cover in more detail on another slide the change in thinking as to how we achieve this, because there's a very expensive way to do it and there's a slightly less expensive way to do it. I won't say inexpensive, but a slightly less expensive way. We want to drive predictability, and this is really key. If you're not providing the same thing every time, or very, you know, a limited number of variants of the same thing, then you've really got to ask, you know, this is what cloud is all about. If you're in an environment where you're doing providing highly customized things every time, then looking at you've got to change your thinking before you can really adopt any sort of cloud. And if that's not viable for your organization, then you have to question about whether or not cloud's a direction that you want to head. But you also got to look at the alternative: is how much is it costing you to do what you currently do, and is that sustainable? Taking a service provider's approach to service delivery. So even if you're with private cloud, I mean, obviously with public cloud, there's a very, you know, we are the service provider, you are the consumer, you have very firm expectations around the service that you expect us to provide. We provide that service, there's SLAs in place, there's potential financial penalties if those SLAs aren't met. It's a very, very clear-cut and understood relationship paradigm there. And what we want to do is, with private cloud, bring that same paradigm to your business unit, so you can say internally, when you click that button, we know exactly how long it's going to take for you to get a service spat out the other end, and we're confident to give you operating level agreements on that because we're confident in our ability to provision that because of the predictability of our process. A resiliency over redundancy mindset. Remember I said that there were two ways to provide that perception of continuous availability: a really expensive way and a not so expensive way. I'll drill into that in another slide in a minute. We want to minimize human involvement because there's no point building these really intricate systems if they're not, to a degree, self-managing and self-healing. How much extra burden do we want to place on the admins? And the answer is really, well, none. We want to try and reduce that as much as possible. And I'll give you an example when I get to the demo, assuming that works. There aren't people around here buzzing around like bees anymore, so I'm assuming that it's working. and there's very distinct things that we do within the system to try and alleviate. These things are complex, right? There's no two ways about it. When you're integrating all of System Center, that's complicated. So what we want to do is try and, there's some things that we can do leveraging the technology that we have that makes those things a little bit less onerous. Optimize resource usage. Well, that's a bit of a no-brainer, right? You really want to get as much out of your tin as you possibly can. Incentivize desired resource consumption behavior. Say that five times really quickly. That is really about, if you're going to provide this perception of infinite capacity, those who are really sort of, you know, hanging on my every word, as I'm sure you all are, when I said before about that problem of VM service sprawl, I said, well, VM service sprawl is a real problem, and then two slides later I say, we want to provide this perception of infinite capacity, you're going, hang on a second, that doesn't quite fit. So what we want to do is, yeah, we don't have an infinite capacity, we want to give people the impression that we're always providing them service, but we also want to try and always encourage them to do the right thing. And we do that via a couple of mechanisms. We do it via what we call hard mechanisms and soft mechanisms. Hard mechanisms are things like quotas, right? You assign a quota to a business unit or a project or, you know, however you've carved it up, to say, right, well, this is the amount of the fabric that I'm giving you. You can't provision over that unless you come and ask me for more capacity. And those quotas assist in your capacity planning for you to be able to know when you're getting close and when you need to provision more. The soft limits are things like showback. So as you see, if my demo works, fingers crossed, when we go to a VM provisioning screen, you'll see that it's almost like a shopping cart type experience with what we display. So when you go shopping for a new car, you go to the Ford website or whatever, you know, you have your base model and then you start picking all your options, go, yes, I want the diesel, yes, I want the, you know, ABS pack, I didn't want leather seats, but hey, they bundle them, I get them anyway. But as you make those choices, you can see the price kind of tick up as you go, and that's the same thing that we provide for a VM. If someone's confronted with a choice, do I want a small, medium, or a large VM, most often than not, they won't know what they want. And there's this thing of, oh, well, better to need it and not have it than, you know, oh, sorry, better to have it and not need it. But so they'll go, what do I want, small, medium, or large? Well, I'll go large. Why not? giving me a choice. I don't know what I want, so I better pick large. So what we do is we show what the implication of that decision is. And again, even if you don't charge back internally, even if you say you display to them, okay, you can pick a large VM, but the monthly cost to the organization is this, then most reasonable people will think twice about the decisions that they're making. Okay, so resiliency over redundancy. For the longest time, we've had this real redundant mindset in IT in terms of keeping things up. So if you want to keep a server up, you have, in most cases, two of everything. Yeah, you know, if you're redundant this, redundant that, redundant power supplies, redundant core switches, redundant cabling, blah, 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 blah. Very, very expensive way of doing things because, I mean, it's effectively doubling your cost. And more than doubling your cost, because it's not just double the infrastructure that you need, then there's that added complexity that goes along with properly architecting and managing those systems. And even with the best intentions and the best designs and the best equipment, out of curiosity, I'm going to get a show of hands from anybody who has supported a highly redundant, you know, two of everything infrastructure, only to have some kind of single point of failure that wasn't anticipated bring the whole lot down. So despite our best intentions, you know, these things do still happen. So what this perception of infinite, what this resiliency over redundancy mindset is to say things will fail. We know this. We're dealing with electronic componentry. Motherboards fail. RAM fails. Disks fail. It happens. We can't prevent it. So what we do is we architect our applications so that they're resilient over a number of servers, so that if we have a loss, the service, which is what we really care about, we don't care about the server, we care about the service that the server is supplying. So if we change our focus to the resiliency of the service, then that's a much better way to go. I mean, a great example of that kind of resilient mindset is the Exchange 2010 advances that were made there in terms of the DAG designs and how you make that resilient cross-server. So if you lose a server, then you know you don't care because the service keeps humming along. And having a percentage of overprovision in terms of your servers is actually a much more efficient way of providing that resiliency than actually trying to double up all of your infrastructure. A lot of the lessons that we learnt as a company, for those of you who were in Jeff's session yesterday, he touched on some of the services that we provide worldwide, things like Xbox Live, Hotmail, some of these really large internet services. So we've been doing big data centres for quite some time now. And we boast, really, I think, the only company who can put their hands up and make similar claims to us is Google. We boast to have the largest and most efficient data centres in the world. And we have to have that because, you know, we're a publicly listed company. You know, we have to be very conscious of the money that we spend. If we're doing things inefficiently in our data centres, that's going to kill our bottom line, right? And that's just not acceptable for us. So we have to be very conscious as to how we do things. A lot of the lessons that those global data centres learnt, we've taken on board for how we architect these on-premise enterprise systems with System Center. We do have to make some adjustments. I mean, there are some things, some practices that they have in those global data centres that we simply cannot replicate in the enterprise because the scale simply isn't there. They do have some efficiencies that we can't ever hope to get to because we're just simply not at that scale. I think one of my favourite anecdotes was at one point, I think they were rolling out an upgrade to Bing and also doing something with Xbox Live. They were rolling out 10,000 servers a month. Right, now that in the enterprise, you can't even think about that kind of scale, right? We just don't see it. So let's have a look at some of these lessons that we've learnt from running our global data centres and how that applies to how we've architected this system. No prizes for guessing that that's not a marketing slide. The first one is resource pooling. Now, when we talk about a resource pool, we're also talking about potentially how we classify a service as well. So a resource pool can be within the architecture of how we do this with System Center is a variable thing. It really depends on your needs and how you're building and what sort of resiliency you want and that type of thing. So a resource pool can be anything from a single cluster right up to an entire data center, you know, depending on how you're classifying your service. So what we tend to find in most cases with these is your resource pooling is done via classification of service. So you may, you know, the typical thing, you know, gold, silver and bronze type service, right? They would be represented as different resource pools, and they may well be backing different hardware. So your production resource pool may be backing, you know, very high cost, high grade storage, and your dev test resource pools might be backing cheaper iSCSI storage or something along those lines. We've given you a degree of flexibility as to how you choose to carve it up, and that's just one example. Ooh, nice cutoff. That says scale unit. So what that is about being able to provide that perception of infinite capacity. So I was talking before about those realities of, yes, we need more equipment and it takes time to put that equipment in. That's a reality, but how do we shield the consumer from that? So we have this notion of a scale unit within our DCS architecture. And what that is the ability to say, okay, I've nominated a particular size of scale as my scale unit that's appropriate for my organization. I mean, in the global data centers, right, a scale unit is a shipping container with 2,500 servers in it. In the enterprise, maybe not going to be that big. Our default scale unit size for our architectures is currently a 16-node Hyper-V cluster. In Australia, I would suggest that even that might be a little large. A lot of organizations may have a smaller, say, you know, 6 to 10-node cluster. Just on that, if any of you are wondering where the 16-node cluster came from, the current architecture that I'm actually presenting you today and that I'll hopefully be demoing you is actually still based on Windows Server 2008 R2. I know 2012's out. Give us some time. We still obviously have a dependency on SP1 for System Center in order to be able to support Server 2012. And then there's a lag also of then us being able to say, okay, well, all of these new features that are being brought to bear in 2012, how do we architect them? How do we surface them to you? How do we, what processes and procedures do we need to be able to run these things in a sustainable manner? So it's not just a matter of chucking, this solution is not just chucking features at you. It's we've thought about how you use these features sustainably over time, and we give you processes and practices to deal with that. So with the notion of a scale unit, we'll say, okay, we've got a 10-node, let's say for argument's sake, 10-node Hyper-V cluster, right? You know exactly how big it is, you know exactly how much capacity it gives you, you know exactly how much it costs, and you know exactly how long it takes you to provision it. So from the time that you place the order with the hardware manufacturer, if it takes 8 weeks end-to-end to be able to provision that, ship the service to you, rack them, cable them, get them in your data center, then you know that you have a 10-week or whatever it is lead time to get that scale unit in. And then you work that into your capacity planning. So we have good reports on monitoring of capacity and how much people are consuming. You know how much quota you've assigned and how much that relates to how much capacity you have within your fabric. And all of those things in concert gives you a very good way of saying, okay, well, I've reached X amount of capacity. That's now raised my red flag to say I need to go and provision another scale unit in order to be able to keep providing that. So you're laying the tracks down, right, on the, you know, as the train's coming. But it's being able to manage it adequately that you have the lead time to be able to do that efficiently. Okay, fault domain. Now, these terms, I'm going to go into fault domain and upgrade domain. These come directly from Windows Azure. So again, we're taking those lessons of our worldwide data centers. Our architects spent a fair bit of time with the Windows Azure guys going, like, well, how do you guys do it? And a lot of those lessons they've brought down. I hate the term domain because it just creates confusion. I'm not talking about an Active Directory domain. I would have much preferred the term zone, but it's called a domain, and there we have it. So fault domain. A fault domain really is simply how much capacity do you need in your scale unit, in your cluster, in order to be able to survive X amount of resource failure and still be able to provide full service. So we call that either, you know, N-1 or an N-2 cluster or however you're going to do it. And that comes down to that resiliency over redundancy mindset is you've got a number of VMs running in your pool. How many boxes can I afford to lose and still run at 100% capacity? Upgrade domain is, again, similar concept, is how many boxes can I afford to take out for maintenance and still be able to provide 100% capacity. So those two things work in concert when you're looking at your fabric designs and how much capacity you're provisioning. For those in Jeff's talk, he talked about the ability to be able to, you know, that cluster aware updating, update my cluster now, and it'll go to the first node. You go to the first node, it'll evacuate it, patch it, bring it back up, make sure everything's okay, and then bring it back into the cluster, and then the cluster rebalances. We've actually been doing that in this solution since two versions ago. We achieved it in a different way because the solution didn't do it out of the box. So we were using a combination of System Center and most particularly the automation power of Orchestrator to be able to orchestrate that work. And then as the out-of-box have caught up, we've then removed our custom processes and just added the out-of-box feature. The very first version of this, we had a very elaborate Orchestrator workflows that coordinated all of that patching. Then VMM 2012 did it out-of-box. So we ditched all of our custom workflows and then just called the out-of-box facility in VMM, and now Server 2012 is doing it out of the box. The cluster service is doing it out of the box. So we'll now either ditch VMM or get VMM to tell the cluster service to do it. So resource decay, and this is an interesting one, is how much, again, it's about how much failure you can sustain. Now, what happens in our global data centers is we get these servers in these massive shipping containers, right? They're sealed, and they're never, ever opened. We know what the mean failure rate is. We know that we can sustain a degree of failure. If a server throws a motherboard or a set of disks or dies for whatever reason, we just leave it in the rack. Just leave it there to rot. And then when that pod, you know, ends its life cycle, we just pull it out, put another one in. Now, from a maintenance point of view, we have to do things that way, because when you're managing hundreds of thousands of servers, you can't afford to send a guy running out every time a red light blinks on a monitoring console. Now, that's not entirely applicable for the enterprise. In the enterprise, if a server fails, are you just going to let it rot in the rack forever? Probably not. But what we do want is to get out of this reactionary way of thinking that when something goes down, you know, red light blinks on the console, straight away there's a guy in blue overalls running out with a new motherboard. We want to get out of that. Same thing for those of you who have kids, right? You know, do you go running every time there's a noise? No, you go running when there's a particular pitch of noise. Ooh, yeah, that one hurt. So you want a maintenance event to be triggered on a particular cycle. Now, that can either be a particular percentage of failure, or it can be a timed cycle, so every 3 months or every 6 months or whatever it is. What we're trying to get out of are those uber expensive maintenance agreements with hardware vendors with the 4-hour SLA support and, yeah, the guy running out in the blue overalls. I think the blue overalls is just a show thing personally, but, you know, this is what we're trying to get out of with this NoSev. I know how much failure I can sustain, and I don't care. I've got a host that's died in my cluster. I don't care. I've still got enough capacity, and I know I've got enough capacity. And then when I lose 20% of my cluster, then I go, yeah, now I care. Send the guy in the blue overalls out. So how we've built this is, now I'm conscious of my timing here because I do want to show you the demo, but I also want to make sure that the demo is going to work. So fingers. Okay, can I switch to the second screen if that's available? I just want to check. Okay, so what I'm going to have to do here is I don't actually have this. I'm going to have to, where are we? Are we that way? Oh, there we are. And we're purple. Okay, so because I am limited for time, I've not got that much time left. I'm going to skip over those last couple of slides, and we'll go straight to the demo because I've got a working demo I can show you. You'll have to excuse me; I don't have it up on my screen here, so I'm going to have to crane my neck to see what's going on. So my driving of it's probably going to be a little bit average. Now, just because I haven't given enough disclaimers, what I'm hooking into here is not on premise here. It's a shared lab in Redmond. So I'm RDPing over a VPN into the Redmond campus in Seattle, and then I'm actually double hopping. I'm going to a jump box and then going in. So I'm going RDP to RDP, which is not friendly to variations in resolution for a start. So I've had to try and squeeze it down into the res for the projector. So what we have here is let me just go to the home page there, so that's some context. For a while there, we sort of had portal overload with System Center. You know, we had 12 different portals to do the one thing. So you'd be happy to know that for this solution, we decided we needed another one. And we went and wrote our own. So depending on, there's three different levels of the solution, kind of like, small, medium, large. Do you want fries with that? The small system uses System Center App Controller as the portal. Medium system uses System Center App Controller with the private cloud services pack, that solution accelerator that you can download. And then the full SKU contains our custom written portal. Now, what we've done with this portal is used its SharePoint services based and authored in Silverlight, but it uses the DDTKH, the Dynamic Data Center Toolkit for hosters. And for those not familiar with that, all that really is a bunch of web wrappers for API calls into System Center. So really, this portal is just making calls into System Center. So we've got two ways of getting into this system. As I was talking about before, service provider's view of the world, service consumer's view of the world. So the portal is the service consumer's view into the world, and the service provider's view into the world is the System Center Service Manager Management Console. So very quickly, to give you some context, what we have is a central system, which is fully the brain of this solution, is System Center Service Manager. Everything goes through Service Manager because we want everything logged and we want everything done by good process. I won't go into it hugely because I'm doing an entire session on that subject next over in room 9. So if process really floats your boat, go over and prepare to have your boat floated. But we want good process control, right? When someone goes to the portal and says, I want a VM, that's raising a change in Service Manager, and you want that logged as a change. Now, to get that agility that we're talking about, that change in this case is auto-approved by the system because it's defined as a standard change within iTool. We know the exact processes that we go to provision that machine, so we can auto-approve that with confidence, knowing exactly the process that it goes through. We don't have to do it that way. If you want, you could use Service Manager to break out into some kind of approval process. You can have it be approved by 20 people in a workflow if you really want to. Kind of goes against the whole, agile nature of cloud and being able to get things quickly, but if you want to dump a ton of process in there, the technology certainly supports that. So let's have a look at, this is our home screen, as you can see, very exciting. There's a nice picture of of some people there looking very happy and friendly. I keep asking them to put a picture of me on there, but they won't do it for some reason. Why are you laughing at that? Anyway, so having a look at our infrastructure management portion of it, we can see, and again, apologies for what I had to do with the resolution. We can see here that we've got within our infrastructure management portal, we can see various. There we go. We can see various what we call user roles within it. So just to explain, it's a multi-tenanted system. So, and we're leveraging how we're achieving this is all through Service Manager and various configuration items within Service Manager. So we have two levels of delegation. The first one is a tenant. So obviously within the fabric, you can assign multiple tenants to that fabric. The second level of delegation is what we call a user role. And tenants can contain multiple user roles. So how you break that up is entirely up to yourselves. A tenant could be a business unit within your org, a tenant could be production versus dev, a tenant could be a project, however you want to do it. Let's say you break it up via project. Then within that project, you've got user roles, and you can say within that user role, okay, I've got my dev test, and I've got my pre-prod acceptance, and they can be separated user roles within that tenant. So the two things that are granular down to the user role level are quotas and ACLs. So we can say, okay, out of my entire fabric, I'm giving this much quota to this tenant, this much quota to this tenant. Then within that tenant, this user role gets this much, this user role gets this much. It's a pretty simple system that the total amount of quota assigned to each user role can't exceed the total for that tenant. And we also ACL down to that level as well. So within a tenant, you can say, right, you have authority to user role A, but you don't have any authority to user role B. And we can be granular with that permission and say, you are just a consumer within user role B. You have the ability to provision VMs, but maybe not delete them. So we can get granular like that. Or you can say, well, you own this user role. You can assign other people and, you know, you can request increases in quota and that kind of thing. So the main reason why we built our own portal in the early versions of this was simply because when this first version of this came out, we were using System Center 2007. There weren't too many good options for that kind of thing at the time. So we sort of went our own way because there was a certain amount of stuff we wanted to provide in one place. As now the out-of-box portals are getting more and more featured, we're now in this place of, do we keep our portal? Do we drop to one of the out-of-box? And that's kind of, we're in this, you know, decision phase at the moment with where we go with it in the future. But one of the things that we do out of this that could potentially be done very, very well by something like the service manager service catalog, for example, is requesting, right, I want a VM and I want these specs and blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is really what the service manager, service catalog is built to do, is to say, facilitate these types of requisition requests. So what I wanted to show you in this portal, though, is, and again, I've been getting killed by the res here, but you can see that I can select various things that are available to me, like my domain, my location, what cloud I have access to. So you might have prod, pre-prod, or gold, silver, bronze, whatever it is. Now it's pulling all this information from Service Manager. These are all configuration items in Service Manager that have cross linkages. So you can say, okay, my gold cloud or this tenant only has access to domain X or domain Y or domains A and B, and they can pick. So we can fully customize who can see what, and we do that through the cross linkages within Service Manager. The portal's simply displaying what Service Manager tells it to display. So number of VMs, just give it a name so I can keep going. I have no idea what I'm typing, by the way, I can't see it. Within the system, we have a choice of a dynamic or a static template, and that's just a construct of all of the bits in VMM, things like OS profiles, hardware profiles, what operating system we're deploying, all of these composite components, and then we're just assembling them on the fly when we go and do the deployment. So again, these are all configuration items in Service Manager that it's just building that profile from. A static is simply to say, okay, I'm giving you a particular choice of what I'm deploying and the hardware is fixed. So you don't get any choice. With this one, you're getting 4 vCPUs, 16 gig of RAM, 60 gig of storage, and that's our standard, and that's what you get. So you can supply a very, four or five or however many, static things and say, right, that's all you get. The other way is to say, okay, you can do a dynamic one, and you can pick all these composite components and build it yourself. So what we surface to a tenant, let's say we get a small VM, and you can see over here that that's actually adjusting, what I'm seeing as I go. And over further to the left, which the res isn't showing me, I'd have to drop my RDP session and go back in for it to give me the full res. But you can see the monthly charge of that adjusting as I'm picking these different things. So again, this is a composite thing to just say, okay, what am I deploying? Yeah, I'll deploy Red Hat. And now it knows that if I'm deploying that, I need to give it a password. Whoops. So anyway, you get the idea. It's going to be a bit difficult with craning my neck. So that was something else that we built into the system as well is Linux is a first-class citizen within this system. So we've got zero-touch deployment for various Linux distros as well, and we're facilitating that again through the automation power of System Center Orchestrator at the back end, which is simply once this is taken, It raises a change record in Service Manager. Service Manager, there's an orchestrated workflow that then picks up that record, reads all the information out of it, and then that determines what paths it goes down in its workflow to say, well, am I provisioning Linux? Am I provisioning Windows? So if I'm provisioning a Windows machine, for example, it's going to go into a set of workflows like deploying the Config Manager agent if required, deploying the Ops Manager agent, hooking it into WSUS, all those types of things. That's going to step through those processes, which obviously aren't applicable to a Linux machine, so it's going to go down a different route within that runbook and execute those different tasks. Just after lunch, I think, I'm giving another session, I think in this room, on Orchestrator runbook authoring best practices, and I'm actually going to use the DCS runbooks as an example to show you how we've authored those runbooks. So some of them are quite complicated, so it's good to get an idea of how advanced runbooks are structured in terms of how modular they are and how they branch out and how we do our error checking, that kind of thing. So you can see there that we've got our, you know, if I want to assign additional disks to the machine, I can do that, you know, give it a size and all the rest of it. Again, this is just all configuration items out of Service Manager. So what I'll do is... have a quick look at that, because I'm conscious that we are running out of time. So what we've got within Service Manager is we have a custom data center services Wunderbar, which is just sort of down the bottom of that screen there. Now that, all that is really is just a set of custom views as to how we slice and dice this data. So all of the stuff's in the data warehouse for Service Manager, and and so it's all in there, and we can slice and dice that data to get whatever views we need. So I can so from here, those things that I was talking about before, things like physical locations, you can see private clouds, you can see we may have a separate VLAN for each tenant, which is usually the way we do things now. Obviously, the network virtualization in 2012 is going to completely change how we think about facilitating those things. You know, what hosts have we got? So these are all the CIs that come into the system. Now, you're probably thinking that there's going to be a huge amount of arduous work for the admin making sure, because some of these things are logical constructs within the DCS system, and some of them are, for want of a better term, you know, real things in something like the clouds, for example. You know, we've got bronze, silver, and gold clouds or whatever that exists within VMM, and VMM has those clouds, and those clouds speak, you know, point to specific host groups that have real clusters in them, so there's a real construct there. you think it's pretty arduous to keep all of these things, you know, making sure that, you know, what I've got in VMM, for example, or what I've got in any of the other System Center products is then related back as configuration items in Service Manager. Because we want that. We want them all to be there. You know, we want that process to be there. So what we've done is, again, through the use of Orchestrator, we've automated all that. We have runbooks that run on timed basis to say, go and look at everything in VMM and go and check to see if there's a CI for it in Service Manager, and if there isn't, go and add one. So we don't have to worry about the administration of keeping these things in sync. The system does it for us. So to give you an example of, let's say, physical locations, if I actually open up that form and have a look, you can see that physical location can then be associated with various things. So when I brought up that provisioning before and I said, yep, I'm provisioning within the Redmond location, it only gave me the bronze cloud to pick from. It's because that's the only linkage and association that it had in here. So I can add, and I can go and add the silver cloud to that. Yeah. And then there's no K button, which I can't get to because of my res, but... so that's how I then would go and say, okay, get out of it. Right, so now if I went back into the portal and said I'm going to provision in the Redmond location, then it's going to say, okay, well, now you've got these two clouds to pick from. And that's obviously, if those clouds are backing onto real hosts, real clusters at the back end, you know, you may have a cluster in one data center, but you may not have that, you know, you may not be providing that service in another data center. So we give it any number of ways that you can carve it up. So... being conscious of time now, this isn't a sort of a canned demo. This is a live system running in Redmond. So if there's anything in particular that you wanted me to drill in and have a look at or show you how it works, I can certainly, as much as navigation around the screen allows, I'm more than happy to jump in and show you. But at this time, I'm happy to take questions. Yep. I'm not going to bring a host down because, like I said, it's a shared lab, so I don't want to start bringing services down. But what I can show you is what we have. If I go into work items, incident management. What you would actually see, if a host failed, for example, the system's going to go much like this. It's going to say, okay, host has gone down. I have reduced capacity in my cluster. So, I mean, ops manager's obviously going to send you the alert saying, yeah, your host is down. The cluster service is going to look after the resiliency of those VMs by basically just bringing them up on other hosts. And then what will also happen is then that alert will automatically, through our orchestrator integration, will automatically raise this incident within Service Manager. And that's sort of bringing all those processes together. So the administrator will either know about it because Ops Manager's flashing a big red light at him, or he's looking at his incident report, his daily incident reports, and it's come up saying, oh, during our patching routine, and this is another thing the system does, is during the patching routine, if it's, say, it's patching a host, it then goes and verifies if that patch, if any of the patches weren't applied, it takes that host out of the available pool and goes, you're not in the cluster anymore because something went wrong. It'll raise the incident service manager. So then the admin knows, oh, for some reason, patch failed to deploy on this box. I'll go and have a look at it, but you know it's not hosting any services because it's been taken out of, you know, it's not an active host to be able to place VMs on. Yep. Yes, it is, because it doesn't actually, what we've built doesn't actually do that out of the box, but it's very possible to do that with Service Manager. Yep, that's a little bit trickier simply because there is a bit of a lag between, you know, the system notification and the updates and those types of things, so it's a bit tricky in terms of, because these things are so dynamic, and if you've got cluster balancing on, VMs are going to be moving around on hosts all the time. Sorry? So that yep. Yeah, it can be, absolutely. You can. There are connectors there to allow you to be able to do that. The thing you'd have to be mindful of is that there is going to be a lag time to that incident occurring or that those updates occurring. So you'd have to be very mindful if you've got cluster balancing turned on to not make it too aggressive. Because if they're moving around so fast that process isn't able to keep up, then, yeah. So you want to be mindful about how you do it, but, yeah, you can absolutely do it. Yes?
Yeah, how do you deal with over-resourcing?
In terms of sort of overcommitment to a cluster or? Okay. So within VMM, we have a setting to say, okay, I want to make my cluster N minus whatever. You can say N minus, let's say we're going to have an upgrade domain and a failure domain. So we'll say the cluster's N minus 2. What VMM does is it's constantly looking at all of the resources that the VMs are taking on that cluster. And if it gets to a point where out of all the machines you have in a cluster, if you can't lose two nodes, it knows that the rest of the hosts left in the cluster can't facilitate that load at 100%, it'll raise an alert and say your cluster is now overcommitted. Because if I lose two nodes, I don't have enough resources to deal with everything. And that's actually looking at the real runtime load. So if you're using dynamic memory, things are sort of upping and downing and you know, moving around, that constant check, it's not uncommon to start to see, oh, the cluster's overcommitted. Oh, no, it's not again. Oh, yeah, it is. No, it's because you're right on the line in terms of that resource usage. So, yeah, a VMM will alert and tell you I'm overcommitted. It does it itself. What you have to configure is the amount of nodes within the cluster that you want to say. And for dev test, you know, you can say zero. So it'll go no, you know, if I'm overcommitted, I can live with that situation. So it's not something that's forced on you. It's just the number of nodes that... And what will happen is if a cluster is overcommitted, you can still forcibly put stuff on there, but the system by default won't let you because with intelligent placement, you get a zero star rating for every host in for that cluster if it's overcommitted. Any other questions? No? Oh, yep. Oh, sorry. Yep. Yeah, you could potentially could. I mean, it doesn't do that out of the box, obviously. What we've built doesn't do that out of the box, but you have the facility of the out-of-box products available to you. So if you wanted to work that in with Team Foundation Server, are you talking about specifically the Lab Manager component, or...? I'd have to have a think about that to say how we could potentially work those things in together. Basically, I mean, as long as things are being logged in Service Manager and you've got a record of what's happening, then yeah. But how we might work the quota into that might be interesting. There'd be a bit of custom work to make that happen, I think. But off the top of my head, I'd say it probably is possible. But I want to have a good think about how we would do it, how long it would take, and whether or not that's viable, is, you know, whether or not the time it would take to do it is worth the output. Yep.
Imagine we need to sell this ideology to your business. Mm-hmm. In one, to phrase how you will formalize or the definition of the private cloud.
So how you would sell it to your business, you would say, it depends on who you're trying to sell it to. If you're trying to sell it to the people who are going to be the service consumers of this, you'd simply say, well, we're going to give you the ability to be able to provision your own infrastructure within an IT supported framework. You don't need to call us anymore to get what you need. You simply go to a web portal and provision it, and it's there for you. But it's done in a consistent way, and guess what? We still support it. From a costing perspective, it's really about that organizational efficiency, and potentially, because of the large degrees of automation in the system, how efficient you can be and then use your staff to go on, you know, other projects. Private cloud is the ability to deliver self-service and usage resource monitoring within your environment. If you want a quick elevator pitch, that's as good as any. The ability to be able to say, well, okay, how much of my IT resources are being consumed by the finance department? And part of it's to sell to, you know, the consumers, but also part of it's to sell to the internal IT to say, well, why do we need this thing? I mean, a great elevator pitch to a CIO is you can tell with a very quick report, you know, who's consuming the most of the infrastructure. So the example I gave before of the dodgy finance application that's taking 50% of your infrastructure, you can quantify that very quickly, and that's a very powerful tool for management. Yes. We're totally dependent on VMM for that, so whatever VMM supports, we support. I'm going to have to wrap it up because I've got to run down for my next session because I'm doing back-to-backs. Thanks very much for your attendance, and I hope you enjoyed the session, and enjoy the rest of TechEd.
came to dance, 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 dance. I hit the floor, cause that's my plans, 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 plans. I'm wearing all my favorite
friends. Put down sucker DJs like the Predator. DJ Nino Brown.
I came to dance, 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 dance. I hit the floor, cause that's my plans, 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 plans. I'm wearing all my. I came to dance, 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 dance. I hit the floor, cause that's my plans, 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 plans. I'm wearing all my favorite brands, 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 brands. Give me some space for both my hands, 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 hands. You, you, cause it goes on and on and on.
Our shadows were down. Understanding myself and my love is wasted. Sorry for the son of a man to be hurting ourselves, and now I'm complicated. You won't get me. I have trouble understanding.